This morning, I am going to be talking about something else very close to my heart, and that is worship. I've been asked to speak about worship as part of our series of Being Church in the 21st Century, and you'll see I've given it the hopefully interesting title of Eyes to Heaven, Feet on the Ground. And in that title, I suppose I'm trying to capture the fact that when we're talking about worship, we are talking about something which is an intensely spiritual activity, but also it has an outworking in terms of what we actually do in our physical presence in this world. And I think if we go one way or the other, too much eyes, just in terms of thinking of the eyes to heaven or just in terms of thinking of the feet on the ground, we perhaps will, in those either of those two extremes, get into problems. But what I want to do is hopefully talk about both of those things in balance this morning. So I will start, as I expect you would expect me to start, given that title. And we would take longer over this if this was a whole morning workshop, but we'll just do it quickly now. What does the word worship mean to you? What do you think of? Don't overthink it. What do you think of when I throw out the word worship? Praise? Show affection? Love for God? Worth? Oh, we've got an English scholar there, actually, because there we go. Old English scholar. Yes. Anything else? Value? Appreciation? Thank you. At last, someone who's honest. Now, I'm not saying the rest of you weren't honest, but the fact is, often, particularly with a group of Christians, we throw out that question, you know, what do you think of when you think about worship? And we kind of tend to go to the sort of higher level things, all of which are true. Love, showing appreciation, giving worth, all of those things. The reality is, if I were to stand up here, in fact, Dave may have said this, I wasn't taking notes earlier on, but if I was to say to you, we're now going to have a time of worship, you would all know what I meant by that, or most of you would, because we have this kind of code within our sort of stream of church that when I stand up and say, or someone else stands up and says, we're going to have a time of worship, you are going to expect us to do what? Sing songs. Which is interesting. A number of years ago now, I was part of a kind of a group, a committee, working through some things, looking at the shape of church for the 21st century, part of a Churches Together in England thing. And they sent out a survey to all sorts of different church backgrounds, church denominations, including New Church, some people I suggested they send the questionnaire to. And the questions were all about, what do you do as a church in your worship? And they were a bit puzzled by the answers they got back from the new churches. So they asked me to kind of decode them for them, because this committee, the rest of them, were rather surprised that all the answers were all things to do with singing songs and music. And that wasn't what they meant at all. Because in the wider church family, if you talk about Sunday morning worship, it means everything that you do, the whole thing, the preaching of the word, the prayers, the singing, yes, everything. But within our stream, we tend to just be talking about the singing of songs. So already within the Christian church, there's kind of different understandings of what this word means. And we're going to unwrap some of that in the next few minutes. So let's look at the big picture. You see, I think the big picture is in the widest and deepest sense of what we're thinking about when we're talking about worship, I sincerely believe that we as humanity, as human beings, we are made for worship towards God. This quote actually comes from the Westminster Shorter Catechism of 1647, which I'm sure you're all very familiar. And it says this: man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. I love that quote. And I love the revelation that was coming to them at just before 10 to 5. No, sorry, at 1647. And the fact that it is, to us, it sounds very modern, you see. And I think, this is a sort of wider bit of debate, really, but I think within our stream of church, I don't just mean River Church, I mean the wider, newer church stream, sometimes we can be I'll use the word, we can be very arrogant in thinking that the things we think and the revelations we have are ours and ours alone, and they've only just come to us. And that what God is saying to us is always completely new and fresh, and no one's ever thought of it before. And maybe God's never thought of it before, so he's never said it before. The fact that it says man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. And all that that implies about our relationship with God, that it is a relational connection, it's a love connection, it's one that's got joy and celebration within it. And sometimes, you know, the way we talk, it's as if we've just thought of that, and everything else that was church before us was all very rigid and didn't have any thoughts of enjoyment in at all. But here it is in 1647, and I suspect they weren't the first people to think of it either. Man's chief end is to glorify God. And glorifying God must be, surely, at the heart of what we're talking about when we're talking about the worshipping of God. Now, of course, as was said in a number of the answers, you know, we occasionally do use the word worship in other settings. For example, who here got married in any kind of traditional church service? Well, you all said it. You know, with my body, I thee worship. Oh, hang on a minute. People worshipping each other, isn't that sacrilege? Well, no, because it literally the word, the English word, does come from an old English word which I can't pronounce. It looks like worth Skippy, but it could be worth Skype, I don't know. But it means to show worth to ascribe worth to. And when we make that commitment to each other in the marriage service, that's what we're saying. We're saying, like, you know, I'm devoted to you. I give complete worth to you. And that's going to have consequences in how I live my life in relation to you and how we live our life in relation to each other. When we're talking about glorifying God, that's what we're saying. We're saying we are giving you complete and full worth in our life. And that's at the heart, that's the central thing, I suppose, that I want to say this morning. If you want to switch off for the next 20 minutes or so and just take that away, that would be enough, actually, for us to meditate on. That our chief end is the glorification of God, to enjoy him. And as we'll see in just a moment, I believe there is a reciprocal element to that as well in terms of how God sees us. But we mustn't skip ahead too far. So we have four things beginning with S this morning. No, we don't. We have three things beginning with S, sorry. And in order to make it work with things beginning with S, we're going to start with singing. But I'm going to expand that to the fact that actually musicians can make instruments sing. See what I did there? So it's kind of singing and music. So the first thing I want to think about, because if we're honest, that's probably the first thing that most of us thought about or would think about if we talk about worship in a church context, is singing. We'll start with that. And here's the feet on the ground bit of all of this. Let's just kind of have some honest thinking. Anyone who's ever been involved in leading worship, by which we mean leading, singing songs, playing music in a church gathered setting. That's what we mean by worship leading usually. It's very easy to, those people will recognize this, it's very easy for us to fall into what is actually a slightly lazy way of thinking, which goes something like this. Fast songs equals praise equals lively stuff, but that's mainly for the congregation. And then we'll move into the quieter section, which we will call worship, and that's where the presence of God shows up. Thank you for laughing, Roger, because we laugh when we recognize things. Now, none of us would actually say that quite as bluntly as that. But it's very easy, you know, we like to think that we're very non-traditional in the way we do things. We get into our traditions. And our traditions are often start with fast, lively music, but that then moves into the deeper thing, which we call worship, which is where we talk about the presence of God. I'm going to show you how that is non-biblical in just a moment. But for that reason, I personally, it's a personal thing, tend to avoid too much of a rigid distinction between what we will call praise, what we will call worship, what we call high praise. Because for me, it's all worship. It's all an expression of giving worth to God. And here's the thing. Music is God's invention, I believe. And it's a very powerful thing. Here's some things which science, which doctors, which psychologists will tell us music accomplishes. It can heal. It's used in pain therapy. It reduces blood pressure. It boosts immunity. It enhances intelligence, learning, and IQ. That's exciting, isn't it? It improves physical performance, and if any of you need convincing about that, just as you're driving around this afternoon or early tomorrow morning and you see the joggers, spot how many of them have got headphones on. Or if you go to the gym, spot how many people have got headphones on. And most of them are not listening to talking podcasts. Most of them are listening to music. And even I, in my very limited experience of running in the gym, found that I did actually run longer and faster if I was listening to the theme from Rocky than if I was listening to something more pastoral. It improves productivity. Those of us of a certain age will remember, and I can't remember what it was. It must have been on the Light program, I think. And it was music that they used to play in factories in order for the people on the production line to work more happily. And can you remember that? It wasn't. Was it Workers' Playtime? I can't remember. Anyway, those of you too young to remember that, bless you. But that's what used to happen. And that's because music improves productivity. It reduces stress. Of course, if you don't like the music, it can increase stress as well. It facilitates emotional bonding. Now, that's a very posh way of talking about candlelit dinners and soft music playing in the background, really. It can change our mood. Music, in other words, is incredibly powerful. And we use music in our gathered settings as part of our worship to God. And I think it's just good to be aware that music in itself is powerful, so we keep our feet on the ground, while still realizing that music is, that's not necessarily dangerous as long as we bear in mind that music is God's idea. And just one very current little, this was, I was reading Metro on the tube a few weeks ago and spotted this little bit and I kept it so you could tell it was a genuine quote. Joining a choir could boost the immune systems of cancer patients. Group singing eases anxiety, which hinders immune activity, say authors of a study carried out with help from the Royal College of Music. I wish I'd made a note of the exact date, but it was sometime in April. That was in Metro. And this powerful, amazing thing that we use in the context of our worship, because in worship we want to release emotion. We want to unlock emotion. We want to do many of those things that were there, actually. Music is God's idea. Zephaniah 3:17 says this. For the Lord your God is living among you. He is a mighty Savior. Now, just bearing in mind what we said about what worship is in terms of what we're saying to God. Now read this. He will take delight in you with gladness. With his love, he will calm all your fears. He will rejoice over you with joyful songs. Unless you think that maybe that's a translation of, you know, that's kind of exaggerating. Actually, this translation is kind of calming down what the Hebrew says. Because that word, he will rejoice over you, in older translations, he will joy over you. The root of that word means to spin around. I'm spinning around. God is spinning around with joy as he sings over you. Which Now, I will say this out loud, aware that it's going on tape, as we still say. So I'm going to be, you know, I'm hedging this around with all sorts of qualification. But, you know, in the wedding service, each says to the other, with my body I thee worship. Is there contained within this a sense in which God is expressing things that look suspiciously like worship as he rejoices over his creation, as he rejoices over his children? Just throw that out as a thought that occurred to me when I was preparing. But let's return to the main idea of why I put that verse up. Music is God's idea. He invented it. I believe he wants us to use it in celebration of him, as well as celebration of many things. Now, if any of you are sitting there and saying, that's all very well, Andy, but I'm tone deaf, music, you know, I have no relationship with music at all. Tim, have we got that video clip? Yeah. This is a guy called Bobby McFerrin. Some of you might have seen this clip. I think this was also contained within a TED Talk, or they used it within a TED Talk. He's at some convention, National Scientific Convention. As well as watching it, try joining in with it. See if you can join in as the audience do here. I believe music is God's invention. I believe there is something which is implanted within us. And actually, just a word out here to worship leaders, musicians, whatever. All of that was contained within the pentatonic scale. Maybe sometimes we overcomplicate things, and we should make sure at least there are some songs that stay within those bounds that everyone can join in with, almost intuitively, something that's built in to us. And as a tradition, you know, we are of a tradition that will sing out in tongues. If you don't understand that, please come and talk to us afterwards. If you listen to where that goes, normally if you leave that to someone to do, just completely extempore without guiding the tune, it will, I'm told, almost always stay within those bounds of the pentatonic scale. Very quickly, some lessons we can learn from the Levites, who were a group of people assigned to worship in the Old Testament. It was kind of their job, the worship leaders. And first of all, in 1 Chronicles 15, 16 to 29. And if you're taking notes, by the way, I'm going to be whipped through a few verses here. I won't have time to unwrap all of them. If you want to take notes, I suggest you write them down. This is from before the temple was built. This is David with the Ark of the Covenant. And let me just read it out to you quickly, shorten it a bit. David spoke to the leaders of the Levites to appoint their brethren to be the singers, accompanied by instruments of music, stringed instruments, harp, cymbals. You see, this goes back a long way, what we do in terms of using music in worship, by raising the voice with resounding joy. So the Levites appointed Heman, those of a certain age think that's funny, the son of Joel and his brethren, and there's a whole list of people, and Jael, the gatekeepers, the singers, Heman, Asaph, Ethan, were to sound the cymbals of bronze, and I expect that was unpopular then as well, and to direct with harps the leaders of the Levites, and Azaziah was instructor in charge of the music because he was skillful. Now, there's a radical thought for a worship leader. Someone appointed because they're skillful at music. Sometimes in our mentality, with so much eyes to heaven, we forget sometimes about the feet on the ground. Not here. We've got really, really skillful musicians in our worship team. But some places I go, it's kind of almost like you kind of by inclination tone deaf and not really, you've only been playing, well, let's make you in charge of the worship because then you'll be humble and anyone who's skillful, we won't involve them. This guy was appointed because he was skillful. So maybe there's a lesson there. 2 Chronicles 5:12-14. This is now the dedication of the temple. And this is just going back to what I said about, you know, God only really shows up when the music gets quiet because he's of a nervous disposition. Heresy. 2 Chronicles 5:12-14. The Levites, who were the singers, all those of Asaph and Heman and Jeduthun with their sons and their brethren, stood at the east end of the altar, clothed in white linen, having cymbals, stringed instruments, and harps, which is already then quite loud. and with them 120 priests sounding with trumpets. Now, I don't know how big this place was, but 120 trumpets are going to be loud in any building. Indeed, when it came to pass, when the trumpeters and singers were as one to make one sound to be heard in praising, thanking the Lord, and when they lifted up their voice with the trumpets and cymbals and instruments of music and praised the Lord, saying, for his good, his mercy endures forever, that the house of the Lord was filled with a cloud of the presence of God. So the priest could not continue ministering because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of God. I've got no problem with quiet music, but please don't ever tell me God is nervous about loud music and we need to wait till the quiet music comes before God's presence shows up. This gives the lie to that. Off my soapbox. I'm going to move on very quickly to my second S, which is sacrifice. Biblical worship, for worship to be biblical, I believe it's got to, thank you, include the notion of sacrifice. Biblical worship always costs something. Genesis 22:5, it's one of the stories of Abraham. It's the one where he's going off with Isaac, and we won't go into all of the ins and outs of that story, but there's going to be a sacrifice in Abraham's head. And he says to the people who are with him, the boy and I are going to go over there and worship. Chronicles 21:24, 1 Chronicles 21:24, David goes to try and buy the threshing floor of whoever it was where he wanted to have the place of worship. And the guy basically wants to give him the bit of land that David's looking to buy for the ark to go. And David says, no, I will not give to God something which hasn't cost me something. Malachi 1:11-13, we haven't got time to read it, but it's a prophetic word about those who seek to worship God in their setting by sacrifice, basically having with an attitude of, that will do. And God speaks out through the prophet and says, am I going to accept a sacrifice that's just something that will do? You know, the diseased animals, the ones that aren't the best. People who are coming with an attitude, it says in the prophetic word, of basically saying, oh, this is really tiresome. This is wearisome to have to worship God. And I ask myself the question, how often do I turn up for what we would call a time of worship and think, can I really be bothered with this? Let's look at just a couple of other passages. The first one is 2 Chronicles 7:5-6, if you're making notes. King Solomon offered a sacrifice of 22,000 bulls and 120,000 sheep. Just think about that for a moment. I know he was king and all that. Actually, worship in this setting was pretty messy as well. 22,000 bulls and 120,000 sheep. And there's a great bit later on in that passage, if you want to read it for yourself later on, where it talks about the fact they used instruments of music that David had created. And it kind of seems to say, as you unpack the verse, that whenever David worshipped, he always said, the mercy of God endures forever. It was like his theme song. It's almost like that would have been his epitaph on his gravestone. Here lies David, who always sang about the mercy and the love of God. It's not a bad epitaph, is it, worship leaders and all the rest of us as well. And then Romans 12, verse 1, where I'm sure many of you thought I was going to reach eventually. So, dear brothers and sisters, I plead with you to give your bodies to God because of all he's done for you. Let them be a living and holy sacrifice, the kind you will find acceptable. This is truly the way to worship him. Because ultimately, of course, we've got to understand that worship isn't just the songs we sing, though it includes the songs we sing, but it is also the lives we live, rendered to God. as a sacrifice that isn't lying on an altar, but that's walking around and being useful. And that is worship. Kerry, I wonder if you could come back. It'd be great if we could do a little bit more sung worship together. And I'll just have my final point just for a few minutes at the end. And as we sing, let's not get too hung up about all the stuff I've just been saying, but let's have in mind that singing is part of our worship. And if you're not by inclination a singer, well, maybe there'll be some stuff within the pentatonic scale. There's something which is built within you that I believe is God-given. Music and singing is God's idea. Let's not be afraid of the quiet stuff. Let's not be afraid of anything louder. And let's have in mind that as we do this, we are presenting a sacrifice to God. Not every song will be the song that you particularly like. Certainly not all the songs that, even the songs I lead aren't always the ones I particularly like. But there are times when we need to make that choice of a sacrifice, of laying aside preference in order to present something to God together. The presence of God came when there was a whole lot of trumpets and stringed instruments and cymbals, but it also says they were all one in that place and sang with one voice. And I think that's important. Amen. And so my third point, we've talked about singing, we've talked about sacrifice. And finally, we worship in spirit and truth. And of course, that comes from a passage in John 4. Context. Jesus is talking to this Samaritan woman, and she tries, probably as a bit of a deflection technique from what he wants to talk to her about, but he tries to engage her in a, she tries to engage him, sorry, in a kind of theological stroke, ecclesiological conversation about where the true temple is. And there's a lot of history involved in that to do with the division of the kingdom going back a long, long time, and a new worship center being set up in Samaria, and so the Samaritans having their worship center, and then the worship center being in Jerusalem. And there was this kind of, you know, conflict between the Jews and the Samaritans. Okay, where is the real worship center? The point being that implied within that is a belief system that says that our worship, to be real worship, is dependent upon location and the right location. Now, I happen to personally believe there is something powerful about buildings that have been dedicated to the worship of God, maybe for centuries or even more recently. But ultimately, we cannot be limited by location, as demonstrated this morning. You know, we've moved all of 20 meters. And I think God's still here. Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. But the hour is coming, and now is," which means it now is now, "when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him." So what does that look like? What does it mean to worship in spirit and truth? Well, first of all, spirit. Just picking up on what I was just saying. Ultimately, our worship is not to do with location. It's not even, difficult though this is for those of us who are really pleased with our new church traditions, it's not even limited to tradition, to style or form. Can I just very quickly let you in? You won't tell anyone, will you? But this is just my secret with you about something that really winds me up. It's when people stand at the front of a meeting or whatever and they say, "This is what God is doing in the earth at this in these days." As if there is only this one thing that God is doing on the earth in these days. And it's the thing we're doing, so you better join in with it. I kind of, sometimes when it usually comes from the West, UK, the States, So I kind of wonder what all the other millions of Christians in China and Africa and the Coptic Christians in Egypt and all of them would think about that, really. That God isn't really involved in what they're doing. What? Because that's not really what God is doing on the earth. He's doing this. Ultimately, our worship isn't about a particular form. It's not about a particular style of music. A sound that attracts heaven isn't down to what delay you're putting on your guitar effect pedal so it sounds like Bethel or Hillsong. It's just not. It's to do with our heart. It's to do with our spirit. And it's to do with truth. So, for example, that means we need to be careful about the words we sing, if we're singing. And did those feet in ancient time walk upon England's mountains green? No, they didn't, so stop singing it. Or stop singing it as a worship song, anyway. Might be a nice little anthem, but it certainly not doesn't belong in worship. Second verse does. We can sing the second verse. That's great. First verse, I'd rule it out. Sorry. Means we need to be careful about the images in our mind, actually. When we talk about we want to go into the Holy of Holies and go within the veil, well, I seem to remember the veil of the temple was torn in two and God escaped from that place when Jesus was sacrificed on the cross. Sometimes some of the things that we have in mind when we come to worship are actually down to Old Testament forms of worship, and we do need to be careful about things like that. But more, perhaps more importantly, truth means that when we worship God in this context, we're not singing and saying one thing today that we won't live out Monday to Saturday. Now, I know there's a place for us actually singing things that we're struggling with and that we're speaking to our soul, our spirit speaking to our soul. We're stirring ourselves up. We're educating ourselves with the truth of God. That's a whole other subject, but I'm saying when we're basically hypocrites, I'm a hypocrite. And we sing songs like, and I got a feeling this might be on the playlist for this morning, but Lord, I give you my heart, I give you my soul. But we don't live that out. When worship is the rendering of ourselves to God as a living sacrifice, day after day, minute by minute. So one last passage. And it might seem a strange place to finish. It's again from 1 Chronicles, and it's about the ministry that was going on around the ark, which David set up. He appointed some of the Levites to minister before the Ark of the Lord, to commemorate, to thank, to praise the Lord God of Israel. Asaph next to him, Zechariah, Jeel with stringed instruments and harps. Asaph made music with cymbals. I love that but. I think the but is probably there. You know, there's like, there's the musicians here, but this guy made music with cymbals. You know, there we go. Sorry, percussionist joke. Benaniah and Jehaziel, the priest, regularly blew the trumpets before the Ark of the Covenant of God. So he left Asaph and his brothers there before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord to minister before the Ark regularly as every day's work required. And his brethren, the priests, before the tabernacle of the Lord at the high place that was at Gibeon to offer burnt offerings to the Lord regularly, morning and evening. And with them, Heman and Jeduthun and the rest who were chosen, who were designated by name to give thanks to the Lord because his mercy endures forever, and with them Heman and Jeduthun to sound aloud with trumpets and cymbals and the music instruments of God. What's going on here? Well, this is what's going on. At regular points throughout the day, sacrifices were offered and music started, and the singers started, and the trumpets blew, and the cymbals clashed, and the stringed instruments played as well. And I'm sure if they'd had a synthesized keyboard, they'd have used one of those as well. At regular points through the day, where the ark was in the middle of the community. And so you would be going about your everyday tasks, and suddenly you would smell the aroma of barbecue, and you would hear the new music. And something in you would say, I should be consciously turning towards God in worship and offering what I'm doing today to him. And that would happen repeatedly throughout the day and day after day. There were fixed points there which reminded the people of their worship to God, of their offering to him, of their sacrifice to him, and his presence with them in their everyday life. So here's my question, worshiping in spirit and truth. What rhythms can we build into our day, into our week, So it just reminds us that every day should be lived in worship to him. And that might be to make the discipline of putting on music of a particular type when you drive in the car, or it, whatever it is. And I haven't got all the answers to this, but what rhythms can we put in place that we worship God continually in spirit and truth? Can we just be quiet just for a moment? Well, actually, no, we're not going to be quiet because Kerry's going to play something. If you notice that, people stand at the front and say, let's be quiet, and then they ask for the music to start. But I'm going to do just that. Kerry, could you play? And hopefully in the last 40 minutes or so, God has said some things into your heart, either through things I've said or in spite of things I've said, to do with the music of our lives, to do with the sacrifice of our lives, to do with worshipping in spirit and truth. And our time's gone. You may just need to feel you need to actually go and leave this place and get on with your worship of God in everyday life. Or you might want to just sit here and reflect on what God is saying to you for a bit longer.